You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. Look for us on Twitter and Facebook by searching for The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. We will be digesting some surprising numbers this hour. We'll be noting that some physicists and rocket scientists are coming to the rescue of Americans, calling out for a better understanding of science. And they're coming to the rescue in the even more urgent mission to deal with the Western drought. We'll also talk about the reality behind Hollywood Oscar glitz. That's our focus as we talk about one of the real characters behind Oscar-nominated film 12 Years a Slave. Our Oscar Week series on how from real people come the best pictures continues. And in a moment, how politicians in Arizona are threatening to ruin more than one cake in the oven over a bill that allows businesses to refuse to serve gays. But here's the surprising number, and digest is the operative word here. According to federal public health data, the obesity rate among children has dropped 43% over the past decade. Is this a moment of glory for 2 to 5-year-olds in the data before they fall victim to junk food and unhealthy eating habits as preteens and young adults? Or is it the beginning of a national trend that's going to move through the population over the forthcoming decade? Cynthia Ogden is on the line with us. She's an epidemiologist, branch chief for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, author of the report. Cynthia, welcome.
Thank you.
Robert Whitaker is also with us. He's a professor of pediatrics and public health at Temple University in Philadelphia. Professor, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, Cynthia, let's get right to this number. How do we digest it? Are the kids actually responding to Michelle Obama or Muppets or something and changing their behavior? Or are we seeing a blip?
No. We have been tracking obesity for some time, and we're lucky enough to be able to measure kids across the country and look at measured values of obesity. And we see that when we look overall over the last 10 years, that there's been no change overall in youth. But among 2 to 5-year-olds, we see some good news. We see a decrease. We saw a decrease from about 14% obese to about 8%.
So what's the impact point? What's the intervention that's happening here? Or are we just seeing something that 2 to 5-year-olds have as a kind of initial condition that then gets wiped away by other forces that take place in culture, school, parenting, whatever?
Well, our study really looked only at the data, and we do know that over a similar time period, we've seen a decrease in sugar-sweetened beverage consumption in youth as well.
So there's no indication that what's going on with 2 to 5-year-olds will translate to 10 to 15-year-olds or, 18 to 30-year-olds. Let's just get that really clear. Right, Cynthia?
Well, it is clear that among adults, there was absolutely no change in obesity over that 10-year period. And in fact, we saw an increase in obesity in older women over 60. But we do know that obesity tracks to adulthood, childhood obesity. So it's really important to deal with obesity in children, because it does track, and in adulthood has many serious consequences.
Cynthia Ogden is epidemiologist and branch chief for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, author of this report that suggests that 43% decline has occurred in childhood obesity among 2 to 5-year-olds. So what's a pediatrician to do with this figure, Robert Whitaker? Do you say, hey, it's all us, the pediatricians, that have accomplished this, or are you just noting a data point that could actually go away as these 5-year-olds become 10-year-olds and 15-year-olds?
Well, the first thing I would say is that it's the parents rather than the pediatricians who are the primary ones responsible for young children's health. And pediatricians work with them more as consultants, I would say. And that any credit here on this trend is probably due to changing social norms, I think, in among parents about how they interact with their children, particularly around feeding.
So you see this as somebody did something, some set of forces were mobilized, and a population of 2 to 5-year-olds changed their behavior on some level. This is not something that's a random occurrence. It's definitely a response to some kind of intervention.
Well, as Dr. Ogden would be quick to point out, these are only estimates, and it's possible that the numbers move around over time, but the trend is certainly encouraging. And if, in fact, there's been a true decrease, it's reasonable for us to think about why that might be. And I don't think there's any one definite answer, but it is the case that at the age of 2 to 5, parents play an enormously large role in determining what children eat. And I think if these changes are real, then we'd have to ask ourselves just what is it that the parents are doing differently than in the past.
So the kind of question that you might ask is, okay, from 2 to 5, there's a lot more parental supervision perhaps. But after 5 years old, the sort of two-income household, the kids are more on their own. There's a more of an opportunity to make individual choices on food. That's the kind of experiment you'd want to do to figure out if you can capture this success in 2 to 5 and translate it to the older ages. Right, Robert?
I would say so. But we need to keep in mind that the demographic shifts in work outside the household are profound. There are many children at the ages under 5 spending time in the care of other adults. And the settings in which those children spend time are not ones that have to date received the most attention in the obesity epidemic. Much more attention has been paid to changing the environment for school-age children than for preschool-age children, infants, and toddlers. We're just beginning to make those changes in the settings where children of that age spend their time outside the home.
Cynthia Ogden, I know this is not your core expertise here, but I just want to carefully ask the question, is this an opportunity? And who should take up this opportunity to capture whatever's going on in this data, Cynthia?
Well, I certainly think it's exciting. When we look at the data, this is the first time we've seen a decrease in any age group. And I did want to point out that this decrease in this age group has been seen in other sources of information. So it's kind of nice to know that it's seen in more than one place to kind of feel more comfortable that this is maybe real.
So who needs to hear this number and focus on taking action, at least from your view? I know you don't want to talk about policy. Cynthia?
Well, I do think it's nice to have a little bit of hope in the whole conversation about obesity has been pretty alarming. And there's a little bit of hope here in seeing these numbers that, you know, we can make a difference.
Well, thanks so much. And congratulations. Cynthia Ogden is the author of the new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention showing a 43% decline over the past decade for 2 to 5 year olds. She's an epidemiologist and branch chief at the CDC. Cynthia, thanks so much.
Sure. Thank you.
And our thanks to Robert Whitaker, professor of pediatrics and public health at Temple University. Thanks so much, Robert.
Thank you, John.
And now a very different kind of story about messages from government and the people who have to deal with them. Angela Sabin, I don't want to put words in your mouth. How you doing today?
Very well, John. How are you?
Now, I suspect you might be saying something like, this is another fine mess Arizona politicians have gotten me and my family into. Am I close to your sense of frustration right now?
Absolutely.
Explain what it is about this bill, 1062, that is making your wedding planning and cake design business in Phoenix really a problem.
Well, it's not making it a problem yet, but if this bill passes, I can see it being a huge problem. Because of the gay community that we do have here, and Arizona is a destination wedding site. 90% of the weddings that I do are destination weddings.
Angela Sabin, of course, is talking about Bill 1062, which is on the governor's desk, Jan Brewer's desk, the Arizona governor. If she signs it, it would mean businesses have the option of refusing services to gays. When you talk about this bill with your friends and other business people, Angela Sabin, what kinds of conversations are you having?
Well, I have to say the majority are against it. There are a few people out there who are not against it and feel that they deserve the right to voice their opinion regarding their religious beliefs. And if they're against gay marriage, that they should be able to turn gay customers away for that reason.
Here's one of those voices that's speaking in favor of 1062. I'm sure you're familiar with Arizona State Senator Al Melvin. Here he is speaking to Arizona Public Media.
It's a frontal assault on all of these parts of our society, conservative mainline churches, the Boy Scouts, the military, traditional marriage, you name it.
Now, Angela, Senator Melvin has been taking that message to the national stage. He was on CNN speaking with Anderson Cooper in a exchange that probably everyone on the internet has seen by now. How does he make you look, your state look? What's your reaction to his religious freedom argument?
Well, I think he makes our state look intolerant, the same way that, in my opinion, the immigration bill made us look very intolerant. It looks like we're all fearful of the gay community or anyone who doesn't have the same religious belief that we have.
Now, you mentioned that this bill, if the governor signs it, would affect the wedding business because Arizona is a destination wedding location. And I want to talk about that in just a moment. But the immigration bill that you already referred to also had a similar kind of impact in your own family. Can you describe what that is?
Yes, my husband owns a contracting business here in Arizona. And when the economy started to fail and the immigration law was passed here and we showed our intolerance for immigration and our inability to provide any outlet for those people who had lived here and raised their families here, they all fled the state. And now that the economy is coming back and construction is back into somewhat of an upswing here, there's no one to fill the jobs. There's no one here. They took their families and they left.
So your husband is struggling because of a perceived intolerance towards immigrants. You're worried about struggling because of a perceived intolerance towards gays. So this has really messed up both income streams in your family.
Yes, it has.
So you think there should be a separation of church and business in the state of Arizona to keep these kinds of issues from coming up?
Absolutely. If they can tell me as an employer, hiring employees, that I cannot discriminate, and that law was passed last year in the city of Phoenix, that I cannot discriminate against a gay person, that I have to, if they are just as capable of doing a job as anyone else, that I have to hire them or I can't fire them because they're gay, then why would they give me the right to turn down a customer because they're gay? It makes no sense to me.
Do you think this law shields people who maybe don't have the guts to put a gays not welcome sign on their front door?
Absolutely. We all have websites. We all have the ability to state right on our websites who we do and do not do business with. So if you're that religious about it and you're that fanatical about it, then state it. Stand up for it. If you're going to stand up to one customer, why wouldn't you stand up to all of them? And then you wouldn't have the problem with them coming to you. But you also put yourself at risk of alienating a group of people. So you either stand up or you don't.
You're a wedding planner and a wedding cake designer. Are you also a religious person, Angela?
I was raised Southern Baptist. My grandfather was a preacher in the hills of Kentucky in the early 1900s and traveled all over. He also taught all of his grandkids, which were very many, judge not, lest you be judged. That is my religion. I don't have to stand behind a church or have a church stand behind me to know what right is right and wrong is wrong. And tolerance is tolerance and love is love. And if you're in the wedding business, you're in it for love because you love the love story. Does it really matter who loves who?
Angela Sabin, wedding planner and wedding cake designer in Phoenix, Arizona. A little bit worried about what Governor Jan Brewer might do. Thanks so much, Angela.
Thank you, John.
Perhaps some of the most important political battles this year may take place in the state of Texas, where the state's electorate will be testing its solid red state credentials in a number of races. It's early yet, just the primary season, but early voting is underway in the race for governor and other statewide offices. For the state house, it's already a GOP war chest versus a Democratic underdog, State Attorney General Greg Abbott, who is running against state lawmaker Wendy Davis. Abbott is oddly spending some of his money to bolster his conservative credentials, calling on rocker, conservative pundit, and outspoken Michigan gun owner Ted Nugent.
We had a Wendy Davis in Detroit. We had a Wendy Davis in Michigan. Her name was Jennifer Granholm. And today, Detroit is an embarrassment. It is a cesspool. There is a declaration of dependence in Detroit. And Chicago, and California, and New York.
Joining us now is Ben Philpott, who covers politics and policy at KUT in Austin. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
So this is a pretty interesting gubernatorial race. I mean, we don't know how it's going to shake out, but in a sense, Democrats in Texas are hoping that Ann Richards' lightning can strike twice. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think that's good. I mean, we've got, you know, we haven't had a governor since her. And so now we've got two females running, you know, one for governor, Wendy Davis, one for lieutenant governor, Leticia Vandepute. And they both are trying their best to kind of channel that excitement and that enthusiasm for a woman candidate like the Democrats had back with Ann Richards.
Is this a Democrats' mobilization issue in Texas, or does this relate specifically to women's issues that will get out the vote that may not translate into wider sort of Democratic Party interests?
Well, I think there definitely is a mobilization effort problem. You don't necessarily see that when you're looking at the Wendy Davis race or the Leticia Vanderpute race. You see that when you look at other races that don't have a big name person at the top. The U.S. Senate race, where John Cornyn is running as the incumbent in the Republican side, you've got essentially five virtually unknown Democrats running. And in a poll that came out this week, the leader at the moment by a wide margin is a woman who's a Lyndon LaRouche disciple and has been disavowed by the state Democratic Party. So obviously there's no organization or messaging within that U.S. Senate race that the Democrats are able to muster.
I mean, the Democrats have a real messaging problem that Wendy Davis helped to solve by getting such a high profile in the abortion controversy in the legislature. But I'm wondering if for Greg Abbott, who wants to be the Republican gubernatorial candidate, if Ted Nugent helps or is something of a step back. It seems like he's pitching for the fringe by having Ted Nugent endorse him.
Right. And it's been interesting, you know, different people that I've talked to. Obviously, it's being kind of spun two ways. The Democrats are saying, you know, look, this is a I think they've basically said, look, this is a horrible person who Greg Abbott is associating with. Therefore, what does that say about Greg Abbott? You would expect that. But kind of the other question coming is, why did Greg Abbott even feel the need to bring Ted Nugent into the fold, to have him be introducing Greg Abbott at a couple of campaign stops? I don't think anyone is going to say that Greg Abbott is weak on guns or weak on constitutional values, you know, all those things that Ted Nugent kind of brings to the party when you bring him into the fold. Really, yeah, it's been just kind of a questioning, why do you need to push to the fringe when you're bringing in someone that could alienate the middle when you weren't necessarily needing to go and grab the fringe in the first place?
And does this suggest that the GOP, or Abbott particularly, is worried about Wendy Davis, that they actually think that this challenge is going to be significant?
You know, Democrats absolutely want you to think that. And there may be some truth to that. We have had a poll come out again this week by the University of Texas and Texas Tribune showing that Abbott does have a healthy 11-point lead in the race over Wendy Davis. So, you know, the truth is at the moment on paper, it's not looking like a particularly close race. But yeah, that's just the big question. We don't know exactly why he would feel the need to go out and try and excite a portion of the Republican Party that the assumption was all along that he already had, you know, sewn up.
The question is, can the Democrats raise money either on the Ted Nugent question or on the Wendy Davis as the kind of wave of the future issue there in Texas? Once upon a time, LBJ never had any problem getting money from Democratic sympathizers, even if they were some of the most conservative people in Texas. What's the state of the fundraising operation for the Democrats right now?
Well, they definitely started behind. Greg Abbott had, you know, $20 million in the bank really before this campaign really got kicked off. But Wendy Davis has held her own through all the fundraising periods since she's been in the race. In fact, we just had the most recent one come out this week, and it showed, it was for the month, the last part of January through the last part of February. And it showed that her campaign raised about $400,000 more than Greg Abbott raised during the exact same time period. Now, then the flip side of that is that Greg Abbott has $30 million cash on hand. Wendy Davis has $11 million cash on hand. And Texas is an extremely expensive state to run a statewide campaign in. You've got, you know, Dallas and Houston and Austin, San Antonio, El Paso, all these media markets to try to buy and get your message spread out across the state.
Ben, before we go, can you make the case that a national audience needs to know more about the race in Texas for agriculture commissioner?
Well, you know, if you think what Colorado did was a good idea with legalizing marijuana, then you might want to take a look at the Texas Democratic primary here. Kinky Friedman, who, of course, made waves several years ago when he tried to run for governor here in the state, is running for agriculture commissioner and would like to legalize hemp. And then as kind of a side project, he would like to legalize marijuana. But that's pretty much the that's the big headline grabber in that race.
But I'd say that's of national interest, unquestionably. Ben, thanks for that.
Thank you.
Ben Philpott covers politics and policy at KUT in Austin, Texas. Running for land commissioner in Texas, by the way, George Prescott Bush, 37 years old. There's a recognizable name. I guess anyone named Bush has to consider politics, but what caused you to consider your line of work? From Fort Worth, Texas, my son Jack has autism. Because of our struggle to access care for him, I became an advocate and now work in government affairs. I've been involved in the passage of autism legislation in dozens of states. God's work inspired by my beautiful boy. Call us, tell us your story, share at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews. Now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com.
So when you think of the famous Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, do you think of them as a good neighbor? Well, sure, maybe on Mars, where their rovers roam, or the outer solar system, where their voyaging satellites beam back data. But JPL is turning its good neighbor instincts to help some real neighbors right here on Earth in the state of California, which is under a drought emergency right now. Dr. Thomas Painter is a scientist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Welcome, doctor.
Thanks for having me.
So you are turning the technology at JPL on answering some very basic questions on a planet right here on Earth, a landscape in California that's looking more and more like Mars. Is that a fair assessment, Dr. Painter?
That's quite fair. Yeah, interestingly enough, the search in the solar system that JPL has been doing, it's often looking for water out there. So it's not surprising that we would then turn it and look for the water on Earth, which is in particular scarce right now in California and in the rest of the West.
Now, some of the tools that you have, you work at the Snow Optics Lab at JPL. What tools are you using to gauge the amount of water, I guess, on the surface, if you're talking about snow optics?
That's right. Well, the project that we have started with the California Department of Water Resources is called the Airborne Snow Observatory, and it takes high-tech instruments to look at the mountain snowpack completely in a way that we've never looked at it. And it allows us to know how fast the snowpack is going to melt and then how much actual water there is distributed across the mountains. So it's a fascinating time, and the partnership with the California Department of Water Resources is quite timely.
So you can look at pixels per square inch and translate that into gallons per minute?
Pretty much, yeah. We are able to keep track of the total water column and then the reflectivity of that surface, and running that through a model, then we can far more accurately know how fast the snowpack is going to melt and how fast the runoff is going to come out of the mountains.
What about below surface water? I know you're in the snow optics department there, but does JPL have any tools to figure out how to measure groundwater or to find new sources of groundwater?
Absolutely. The two other components that JPL is looking at strongly are groundwater using what's called interferometric SAR, or synthetic aperture radar, and that looks at groundwater pumping and the displacement of the surface due to that, and then also soil moisture. And in fact, later this year, NASA is launching a JPL-built space mission called Soil Moisture Active Passive, SMAP, that will look at the soil moisture across the globe in the top 5 centimeters.
You know, because I love you guys at JPL, I'm assuming those little alarms there are like new sources of water being found by your computer. But of course, I know that's not the case. Do you ever worry, though, that California could end up, the place where so much of America's food comes from, could end up looking like Mars?
Well, so droughts do happen, and multi-year droughts do happen as well. And so it's not surprising that we've had 3 years of drought here. And in fact, in the Colorado River Basin, so the Southwest U.S., has been in arguably 14 years of drought. And if you look back into the paleo record, so looking back a few thousand years, there are times when we have 30 to 50 year droughts. So it's not surprising that we have a 3 year drought. And this year in particular is tough because to date it has been the lowest precipitation in the mountains in the record.
Well, it's an eye blink of history. Keep up the good work, Dr. Thomas Painter, a scientist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Thanks.
Thank you.
Seasonal question here. Who is more miserable than someone selling sunblock in Minnesota in February, right? Sandals in January. The snow shoveler in Duluth in March or May. If you hail from the land of 10,000 frozen lakes, you may talk a lot about how it will hit 23 below zero in International Falls today or 15 below in the Twin Cities or 8 below in Winona. But would you want someone to actually measure that misery, add it all up, average it into some kind of handy index? This is the job, though, of Pete Boulay, assistant state climatologist at the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, who compiles the annual Winter Misery Index. Pete, welcome to the program.
Hi, John. Glad to be here.
And how are we doing? He sounds like he has a smile on his face. Pete, are you smiling?
Well, I am a climatologist, so, you know, if I was in Hawaii, weather is pretty boring there, so we need to be where there is interesting weather, and Minnesota is one of those places.
So is there an equation for precisely determining the misery index in Minnesota? And is there a big, like, coefficient C for cold?
No, it's not that complicated. I just assign points for cold and snow, depending on how cold and snowy it is.
And is this year particularly bad?
Yes, we're in the severe category now of winters. Every time it gets below zero, I assign a point. At or below zero gets a point. If you get 1 inch or greater snow, gets a point. Then I get bonus points for extreme cold and extreme snowy. This winter, we've had both, and we're really getting up some pretty high points in the scale so far.
How would you gauge a winter, say, in the Northeast, where it goes from 53 degrees to 20 below in the matter of days, and you get tons of snow, and then it all becomes slush, and then it gets frozen into a sheet of ice? You got different point scores for those experiences.
Yeah, that gets a little more trickier. It's hard to quantify freezing rain events and that kind of impact. I try to get a little handle on that for a real misery winter is one that has persistence, and for that I have a point system for 12 inches of snow on the ground or more. Every day that happens, you get a point. So far this winter here in the Twin Cities, we've had 34 days of at least a foot of snow on the ground or more, and around here, the issue becomes where to put all that snow.
And what's the point score literally right now for this winter on the misery index? Where does it stand?
Well, for the Twin Cities, we're at 177 points so far. The record's 305, so we have a ways to go to break a record.
Now, do your neighbors ever come up to you and say, Pete, no, it's way over 300. I'm feeling it's way over there. You got it
all
wrong.
Yeah, I think absolutely. You know, it's especially driving around town here right now is definitely a challenge. The ice fused to the streets around here, so many people are slipping and sliding around. So the highways are better, but the side streets are still pretty rough.
Now, do you do this because the Department of Natural Resources needs this data to assess something about its budget or its services, or is this something you're doing to basically showcase the work of your office?
Well, it's something I've always wondered as a kid. A local newspaper around here had something called Pain in the Posterior Index, and it was done by a reporter there, and then he retired, and they did it for a few years after that. But it's something I've always been interested in, are the winters when you were young worse than they are now? And this is kind of indexed more or less for fun, come up with trying to get a handle on how severe a winter is, how much misery you feel during a winter.
Well, I suspect the Midwestern climate inspired you to be a climatologist, but this misery index was inspired by the pain in the posterior index from days of yore, right?
That's right. That's right.
A bit of his role. Pete, you keep up the good work as well. Keep chronicling that misery, and maybe we can figure out a way to nationalize it, don't you think? Pete, thanks so much.
Absolutely.
Pete Boulet is assistant state climatologist at the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. He compiles the annual Winter Misery Index for Minnesota. Here's another moment to dream about during the upcoming Academy Awards ceremony.
And the Oscar goes to 12 Years a Slave. Here to accept the award is Clayton Adams.
Thank you, Steve McQueen, Chiwetel Lupita, the entire cast, Michael, everybody, for being able to bring my great-great-great-grandfather's story to life, to be able to educate the entire world. His perseverance, his love, his faith has been handed down from generation to generation, and I just want Solomon Northup to be proud of his descendants as we are of him.
Clayton Adams there will not be accepting any awards for the film 12 Years a Slave. He had no part in the Hollywood production. Instead, he carries the history behind the film in his blood. He is the great-great-great-grandson of Solomon Northup, who wrote the book the film is based on, 12 Years a Slave, about his experience of going from being a free man with a family, a noted violinist from Saratoga Springs, New York, to being abducted and forced into slavery back in the mid-1800s and then regaining his freedom 12 years later.
Days ago, I was with my family in my home. Now you tell me all is lost. Tell no one who I am. That's the way to survive. Well, I don't want to survive. I want to live.
Our series, From Real People, The Best Pictures, this week is examining some of the true life characters behind some of the Oscar-nominated movies. Clayton Adams learned he was the great-great-great-grandson of a famous slave when he was just a rowdy teenager.
I was getting ready to go to college, just finishing up my high school years, and my mother came across the book that was given to her by her mother, Victoria, and I read the book twice, but the second time really understanding that this is a part of my blood, and with that in mind, it truly brought me to tears at the end of the book.
And there's two issues. One, the horror that is recounted in that story. And then number two, the idea that it is so rare for an African-American man to be able to trace their history back as far as you can.
That is correct, because as an African-American, it has always been hard because of the slave industry to be able to trace back our history. It was truly a missing piece in my life that was finally, the puzzle was finally put together. So it was amazing.
What's it like sitting in the theater watching those images, watching that film?
Well, I saw the movie three times. It took me three times just to be able to stay to the end to actually see the ending.
Now, when you say it took you three times to see the movie, is that because it was too upsetting to stay to the end of it because of the images?
Of course. Of course. I mean, as I stated before, I've read the book, and the book is obviously detailed, and it's different when you have the visual as compared to your imagination. It kind of makes it even more real. Just a normal, everyday slave life on a cotton plantation.
Normal, everyday slave life. Isn't that a crazy thought?
That is
man.
I thought I would never say
yeah.
with a straight face.
No
but
kidding.
I mean, that was just the reality of that time, unfortunately, in American history.
How did seeing the film change your sense of the history that you carry, what responsibility you have in your life to Solomon Northup?
My mother told me at a teenage years, and after I read the book, I made a promise to myself that for any future children that I have, I will make sure that they know about their history, their ancestry at a younger age than I. And taking my daughters back to Saratoga Springs, New York, where in July 1999, I'll tell you the exact date, the 24th, Saturday, was the first annual Solomon Northup Day, a celebration of freedom. And we had over 40 descendants of Solomon Northup that came from all over, even from Louisiana. And as far as California, my grandmother, Victoria, flew all the way from Los Angeles at the age of 90 years old to attend this event that honored her great-grandfather.
You know, he was a violinist, Solomon was, right?
Yes, he was, and, indeed.
But for this horrible abduction and imprisonment for 12 years, he might and his descendants might have been violinists and string players playing at Tanglewood, which is a concert facility not far from Saratoga Springs, a place where the best in the world play music.
Wow.
Have you ever thought of that?
Never even knew of that. I will have to look into that. I know my daughter, Charisma Adams, she has been taking up the violin. She's in eighth grade now for the last 4 years. I taught her about Solomon Northup at the age of 4 or 5 years old. So when she got the opportunity in fourth grade to choose what instrument she wanted to play, and she picked the violin because she wanted to make her grandfather proud.
So are you rooting for a statue?
Of course.
What do you win if the movie wins, do you think?
I have already won just being able, as I stated before, one of the fortunate African-Americans to be able to trace their history back all the way to the 1800s. I mean, that right there is great for me. But having Solomon Northup's story, which was left out of American history, not just African-American history, but American history for going on 200 years now, I mean, that in itself is pride enough that his story is finally being told worldwide. It's already been bigger than any statue. And I just wish that my grandma Victoria lived long enough to be able to see this. But I know she's in heaven now with Solomon, and they're just having an exciting time together.
Clayton Adams, great-great-great-grandson of Solomon Northup, the author of the memoir and subject of the film, 12 Years a Slave, nominated for 9 Oscars, including Best Picture.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Finally this hour, you gotta figure that someone who is willing to go on national television to instruct professional know-it-all performance artist Stephen Colbert that he needs to learn something about the theory of relativity, you would assume that someone willing to take that kind of humiliation has got to be pretty passionate about science.
We all have this in our mind that time just ticks forward second after second after second. Like that, right there.
Exactly like that.
But that fools us into thinking that time is the same for everyone. If you were to get up from this table, run around the room, and come back, your watch would tick off less time than it would have if you were just sitting still.
Why?
You gotta take the course. But here's the thing.
The course that Columbia University professor and science evangelist Brian Greene is talking about there to Stephen Colbert is World Science U, another entry in the online education universe, along with the Khan Academy and institutions like MIT offering their courses online for anyone curious to understand science beyond simply watching Nova or science fiction movies. Brian Greene says the level of popular interest in science has grown since he was just a nerdy student looking for answers. Today, he says, people are ready to grapple with the big questions.
A lot of what I've done in terms of bringing science to the public has been whetting the appetite, getting people inspired about Einstein's notions of space and time or the Big Bang, black holes, things like that, which are inspirational. But World Science U is going the next step and offering the full meal where someone can dive in and really grapple with the core ideas that science has come up with in the last 100 years. We're starting with Einstein's relativity, special relativity, so people can jump in and really grasp what Einstein found back in 1905.
Now, you're competing on some level, or you're standing with, you know, entities like the Khan Academy, which, you know, works on maybe trigonometry, less special relativity, but still they do some very challenging topics, and it's all online. And there's open course work that MIT has pioneered really for decades, and there are other places where you can get sort of lecture videotapes, that sort of thing, of real discussions of real science.
Yes, and all of those undertakings are great and valuable. The one thing that's really different about what we are doing is that we're not just using the internet as a delivery vehicle. So most of the undertakings that are out there are providing what I would consider sort of old-style teaching in a new delivery mode. We're trying to use the internet to create a new educational experience where it's highly visual, highly interactive, and it allows you to grapple with the ideas in a manner that I consider even more effective than real live classroom teaching.
Now, I suspect this falls short of me being able to email you at 3 in the morning with a question about Higgs boson.
You can.
I can, but not everybody else. But are you creating, in a sense, a kind of customer service modality where you can set up a chat with someone who knows, maybe a grad student, maybe a student, who can answer specific questions about a lecture that's delivered online?
Well, I will be online live for part of the time each week, so people will be able to ask questions in the manner that you're describing. But there's another feature of the site that I think is quite effective in dealing with exactly the issue you're raising, which is, look, a good faculty member who has experience can anticipate 80 to 90% of the questions that a student is going to ask. So in our digital offering, I answer those questions. So there's a modality where you can interact with me. It's not truly live, but it's the next best thing. You pick from a menu of questions that really are the ones that I have found swirl around a student's mind when they're trying to learn this material. So it's not exactly live, but it has the trappings of it.
What is this moment that we're living in right now where there does seem to be a fusion of enthusiasm about science and a sense that there's a need for people to be more scientifically fluent with the characters such as yourself? You know, I'm thinking of Carl Sagan in Another Generation. It seems like there are a lot of scientific evangelists out there all of a sudden.
Well, I think the world has certainly come to recognize that science is our future, and scientists have come to recognize that it is the general public that ensures that science will be healthy, that it will be adequately funded, that there will be a next generation of students who are excited to take the torch and push things forward. So there are many causes that are coming together, recognizing that we need to do a better job of educating the general public. And the key thing in that, which makes the internet so exciting, is that digital innovation can help with that enormously. When I try to teach kids, say, about the slowing of time, one of the wondrous ideas of Einstein, with a piece of chalk and a blackboard, when I'm trying to explain it that way, it's really tough. But if we have carefully crafted animations, visuals that make the ideas intuitive, I see the students get it in a nanosecond compared to an hour using the traditional methods.
So let's talk a little bit about your mentor. Who mentored you face-to-face? I mean, I suspect it wasn't just visual effects on Galaxa or a video game that you put quarters in when you were little.
No, I was fortunate. I had a young graduate student when I was a kid. I was in junior high school. There's a graduate student at Columbia. I just literally knocked on his door cold one day and said, "Hey, will you teach me?" And he did.
He was your Carl Sagan.
In a sense, he was. And we would, of course, do it in the traditional way. His name is Neil Bellinson, and he would just work with me, solving equations, setting me problems, things of that sort. But I tell you, my level of comprehension of these ideas would have been much further ahead if I did have the visuals that we're talking about. When you learn things, you're always trying to build in your mind some visual imagery of abstract ideas. That's the challenge of learning science. And if we can provide rich visualizations that allow the student to enter the strange world of the quantum, or the strange world of moving fast, or the strange world of general relativity where gravity is strong, wow, then all of a sudden you get it in your bones, and that's very different.
So, Brother Green, it is not the Carl Sagan you should focus on. It is how you are open to the Sagan phenomenon in the universe.
There you are.
Brian Green, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Brian Green, physicist and string theorist, professor at Columbia University, and chairman and co-founder of the World Science Festival. Brian Green. Now that is one very happy scientist. And Brother Green certainly has it in his bones, don't you think? Who was your Carl Sagan science mentor?
Hello, my name is Ann Cummings, and I'm calling from Greenbrae, California. My father became a theoretical physicist when he met an inspirational teacher. He would tell me, you have to learn the boring stuff, but it gets better. When I graduated from Berkeley with a degree in biophysics and English, and I had volunteered and worked with patients and with data, it was a conversation with my father about doing something in the real world of day-to-day life that prompted me to apply to medical school.
It's a great story, Anne. So Daddy was kind of your Sagan, but it was more visuals for Sarah in Dallas that gave her the push to get into nuclear medicine. I am going into a program to become a nuclear medicine technician. I chose that field because of the numerous CT scans that I have had, some good and some bad experiences. Who inspired for you to do what it is you do in science or your chosen field? You have a Carl Sagan. Share your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening and allowing me to be your Carl Sagan of the day. I'm John Hockenberry, though. Sorry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews. Now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.